You know, I noticed one thing about myself here in the last few years. It's kind of weird for me. Is I've gotten this interest a little bit more in history of things. And you know, when I was high school, history was not my thing. I didn't care for it. And you know, especially when I come here and I've got to be a part of this church and I see the rich history of the church, I've just kind of been fascinated by, you know, by some of the things there. And we've talked about some of the architecture of the church and why it was there. And you know, this window over here, we're going to talk a little bit about today. You know, that painting, you look at that painting, you think, you know, they're probably ancient things, go way, way, way back. You know, these things were created, you know, shortly after Jesus lived, you know. But, you know, that painting there was painted by a German dude by the name of Bernard Plockhorst. I like that name. But he did this just really a few years before this church was built. I'm kind of fascinated by that. That painting, it seems like it's older, you know, ought to be something maybe from the Renaissance or earlier or something. But same with that one. Both of those paintings were done just a few years before the architects decided to build this building. And they selected these contemporary paintings to be a part of our sanctuary. I think it's kind of a cool thing. But you know that painting there is called the Good Shepherd. And it is based on a passage that comes from the Gospel of John that says, I am the Good Shepherd, and the Good Shepherd lays down his life for the sheep. And we've talked quite a bit and quite extensively about Jesus being our shepherd, and he is the one that we are to follow. But you know, there's another very popular passage in the Old Testament that would have been written about 1,000 years before John would have penned that passage that inspired that painting there, and it comes from the book of Psalm, and it is the 23rd Psalm. How many of you have heard of the 23rd Psalm? It's a popular psalm, and a lot of times we read that psalm at funerals, and it's done at different instances. And I would bet, I'm not going to have anybody do this, but if I asked you, could you stand up and could you do Psalm 23 from heart, and I bet there would be some people that would probably say, yeah, I could probably do that. But, you know, what I wanted to do today, I wanted to read this together. You know, I read out of the New Revised Standard Bible quite often. That's what I carry. That's what I use. Once in a while, I use the New International Version. A lot of you carry that. But sometimes we just got to hear the good old King's English, the King James Version of Psalm 23. It just rolls better. So it's in the bulletin if you can't make it out on the screen, or if you want to read it here. Let's read this psalm together as a body. Would you read with me? The Lord is my shepherd, I shall not want. He maketh me to lie down in green pastures. He leadeth me beside the still waters. He restoreth my soul. He leadeth me in the paths of righteousness for his namesake. Yea, though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, I will fear no evil, for thou art with me. Thy rod and thy staff, they comfort me. Thou preparest a table before me in the presence of mine enemies. Thou anointest my head with oil. My cup runneth over. Surely goodness and mercy shall follow me all the days of my life, and I shall dwell in the house of the Lord forever. There is something about King James on that, isn't there? It's good to put words at the end of our sentences. We do that a lot in that translation. But you know, there is a very powerful line, I believe, at the very beginning of that. And it's a confession that David, the author of that psalm, says, the Lord is my shepherd, I shall not want. The Lord is my shepherd. And he is confessing something very, very powerful there. And what that is he's saying, I'm not in control. The Lord is. I am not the one that is in control. Rather, I am a sheep, and as a sheep is to the shepherd. And this whole business of control, you know, that's a problem for people, starting with me. We have control issues. We have this bent about us, this desire in us that we want to be in control. And think about this. You sit down and you turn on the TV. Who gets the clicker? It's kind of a control thing, isn't it? Oh, yeah, couples are looking at each other and giving each other dirty looks right now. Oh, yeah, it's an issue. It's a control issue, isn't it? Who gets to choose Who gets to choose the channels? And no doubt, we call it buttons at our house, and everybody freaks out when we talk about it. It's the buttons at our house. And what are you talking about, the buttons? That's the remote control. But, you know, on the bigger things in life where we would struggle with control, and I will be the first to admit, you know, I'll share with you right here. At this point in my life, I struggle with control. I want to be in control of things. Even as my kids are grown, you know, there's still this element in me that kind of wants to have a controlling element to their lives. And they're, you know, in their 30s. And we have that as parents sometimes, that sometimes there's a control problem that we have there. And another point in my life that I'm having right now is just this whole business of where I am as I approach retirement. I want to have control over this. I want to have this timeline set in place here that I want to control my finances so that they're here and I can control this and I'm here and this. And even to the point where I feel bad, I'm, you know, trying to control Carla's decision on this as well because that fits into my plan too. And, you know, that's her decision. And yet I have this control thing. I have this thing about me that wants to control. And my role here as your pastor, that's a battle that I have to have as well. That, you know, I want to control things. I want Joel to be in charge of things that they're not mine. This is not my church. This is his church, and it's more your church. I'm here to serve him and serve you for this short time that I get to be here. But I have this control thing about where it is we ought to go and what should our focus be and what are the things that we should be involved in? And what are we going to do with the denominational decision? And I want to have control over all of that. It's a battle that I have to fight, you know. It's this natural thing that we have. How we worship together, you know, I think about that. Well, what should this time and space that you and I have together for this short time of 1 hour a week, you know, I want to have control over that and to make it the best thing possible. So it is this thing. I have this about me, and I'd ask you too, are there things in your life that maybe you have a control issue with as well as you reflect on your life? So when I think David says this, I think that is it's a great confession that he makes, especially as we dig into a little bit and find out where David came from and his background to be able to say a statement that really relinquishes his power to be able to say, the Lord is my shepherd. That says an awful lot. Says, I ain't the one in control. It's the Lord who is in control. So I want us to look a little bit about this David dude that wrote this psalm. And I want to go back a little bit. I told you at the beginning here, I'm kind of into history a little bit more, which is just so not like me that I'm into this. But man, there is some fascinating stuff that leads up to David. And the fact that he wrote this psalm, that it's so important to our lives. You know, this is a sketch from a diagram that we had last week when we were talking about God's plan through all of history. That, you know, he's on this business of just chasing us down. He loves us so much, and he's after us. He's pursuing us, and he's going to get us. And he does this by starting a plan that started way back with a couple of folks named Abraham and Sarah. And he built this nation called Israel, who eventually brought us Jesus Christ, who ultimately is the one that allows us to be restored back into relationship with himself. It's an incredible story that we talked about last week. But I want to pull away from that story a little bit and talk about some other characters that maybe you don't think about a little bit. Abraham had a nephew whose name was Lot. And Lot and Abraham's family started to get pretty big. And there was a little bit of competitiveness on pasture grounds and lands and herds and all that stuff. And so they end up separating. I'm going to make this long story shorter. And Lot ends up in the regions of Sodom and Gomorrah. We know about those. And that's where he's at. But you know how that story goes, that God comes and through Abraham tells him that he's about to destroy Sodom and Gomorrah because of the vast immorality that is taking place in those two towns. And you know the story about those. And he tells them, and he gives them instructions here on what they ought to do. And Abraham tells, get out of town. And so Lot tries to get all of his family members to go. And God told them, when you leave, he gave them commands. Get out of here and do one thing. Don't look back. Don't look back about what I'm going to do. Well, here's a control issue. Lot's wife wants to be in control. She's got control problems as well. And even though God commanded her not to look back for whatever reasons, she wanted control. She looked back, and you remember the story. She turns to a pillar of salt. It looked just like that. It looked like a bottle of Morton salt with a head stuck on top of it. That's what happened there. She had a control problem. But the control problem goes on because Lot and his two daughters, that's all that's left, they move to some isolated region. And the two daughters get a control issue as well. They get stuck. They think, you know what, our husbands are gone. We got no men around here. What are we going to do to keep our families going? I'm going to speak cryptically here for children that are here, and I'll let you fill in the blanks a little later. So what these two women do to take control of a situation they think is bad and not allow God to do his work is they intoxicate their father, and they do an act so that their father and each of them produce offspring. You fill in the gaps later on with your kids. But what happens, there are two sons that are created here, Moab and Ben-Ami. Those are the two sons who develop entire nations beneath them. And both of those nations or those groups of people are enemies of Israel up there on Abraham's side. Ben-Ami's group gets to be called the Ammonites. And you hear about the Ammonites and they're always battling Israel. The top group are called the Moabites, and they're always battling Israel as well. So those two women took control of a situation, but they didn't wait for God to do his work, and things happen. One famous Moabite that comes out of there over to the lower right is a woman whose name is Ruth. You've heard of Ruth. Ruth has a whole book in the Old Testament written after her. Ruth is a Moabite. So here we got a couple of people who, again, control issues and the result that took place. But let's go back to Jacob here and think about this nation of Israel. We'll get to Ruth here in just a minute because she plays an interesting part in the story. Remember, Jacob had control issues as well. We talked about this last week where Jacob's brother Esau, he had control issues as well. You know, he's got this birthright and he's got this blessing and he is supposed to be the person that God is going to use to build this awesome nation to be able to bring the Messiah so that you and I would be here. But he's got control problems. He just throws that away and he's hungry and he wants some of that award-winning broccoli and cheddar soup that I had to live with all week. And so he, through his control issue problems, lets all that go and loses his birthright and his blessing. And Jacob has control issues as well because he sneaks around and steals those things from his brother Esau. And what happens then is Jacob then is the one by which God's going to use to bring Israel, this nation, and eventually Christ. Jacob is the one that has these 12 boys. And you know about these guys. These are the 12 tribes of Israel. Judah is one, and Benjamin is one, and Joseph is one, and Dasher and Vixen or whoever they are. I don't remember all the other ones, but there were 12 of them, and those are the 12 tribes of Israel, and Judah is the oldest one. And I point that out because there's some more control issues here again. The Lord is my shepherd, David says. But we've got people with control issues. Let me tell you a story about Judah and Tamar. Judah's got boys, and Tamar is married to one of them, and all the boys end up dying, and Tamar is kind of in the same pickle as the other two women, and they're worried that they're not going to be able to have children as well. I'm going to speak cryptically again here. The Bible's very clear on it, but I'll speak cryptically here on a Sunday morning. Tamar does this. She dresses up as a woman of the night, and she arranges it so that her father-in-law and her will do what a woman of the night and another man would do. The result of that is Tamar becomes pregnant, and she bears a child whose name is Perez. Took control of the situation again, and the result was this child that was born, Perez. A few generations later, after Perez, maybe a great-great-great-grandfather to Boaz would be Perez. Boaz is Ruth's kinsman redeemer. And now you kind of remember the story of Ruth. Ruth's husband is Boaz that came from that line. And those instances in history where people decided, I'm going to take control of this. I'm not going to let go and let God. I'm going to do it my way. Boaz and Ruth have a child whose name is Obed, whose son is Jesse, whose son is David. There we go. The man who wrote Psalm 23. Who's the human descendant to Jesus. Isn't that fascinating? You know, that stuff was in the Bible. It kind of sounds like it's some, you know, R-rated stuff, but it is, it's true. And I think it is, it's fascinating that that is part of this awesome story that we have. And what to me is even more remarkable is divine Jesus Christ came through a very, very human genealogy, didn't he? You look back, you go to the book of Matthew, and that's where all these genealogies are found, a book of Luke as well, and you could trace this back. Those are the people that are in Jesus' history. Isn't that fascinating? How God chose to come to us through a nation, but not through a whole bunch of just tremendously holy, perfectly upright people, but people that are pretty human. People that definitely have got some control issues. So many times as you look back and you see people throughout history in the Bible or people in our own history, it seems like they're more bent on working on their own will, what I want to do, what my will is, rather than waiting upon the Lord. So David would have known those people. This history, David would have known the position he's in when he would have written this psalm. The Lord is my shepherd and I shall not want. He knew those people. They were part of his rich heritage. They were his ancestors. And he would have known that, and yet he penned those words. But even David himself, you know, David, he's kind of the Dwayne Johnson, I think, of the Old Testament. He's kind of the rock. You know, you think about things that we say about David, you know, King David, the line of David, the star of David, the city of David. His name pops up an awful lot. David is this person for the Jewish people, kind of a rock star, probably kind of like the Rock. And how he came into being is kind of interesting. Let's sweep through this just a little bit because it gives a little background. I think it's very important about how his background would have helped him shape his mind as he penned those words. The Lord's my shepherd. I'm not in control. I shall not want. Israel, the very nation of Israel's got a control problem. Man, I'm saying that a lot today. God's chosen people has a control problem. Israel comes to the judges at the time and says, you know what? We want to be like all the other cool nations, and they all got kings. We want a king too. And God said, don't do that. Don't ask for a king. That's not the way we're going to do it. Nope, we want a king. We definitely want a king. And so ends up Israel decides to go and have a king. And the first king's name was Saul, and he was a real bonehead, and it just didn't work out. He ends up getting dethroned because he was just a piece of work, and it did not work. And so they're looking for this new king. And so Samuel, one of the last prophets that comes along, gets a word from the Lord and said, I want you to go to Bethlehem, and I'm going to show you who your king's going to be. And I pick up the story in the book of 1 Samuel, and I, of course, find humor in a lot of things, but he goes there, Samuel goes to anoint this king, and it says, go to Jesse the Bethlehemite. Jesse is from Bethlehem. Oh, remember Christ's lineage where Joseph was supposed to go to his town to be registered, and he had to go to Bethlehem because he was from the house of David. That's where this starts. That's why we have that there. So Samuel goes there and he says, go find Jesse, and I'll tell you which one of his sons I'm going to pick. And it's an awesome story. Because Jesse goes and he starts pulling out these kids. And the first one he has is called Eliab. And he says, surely this has got to be the one because he's the big guy. He's good looking. And the Lord says, nope. Don't pick him. Man looks on the outward side. I look at the heart. I look at that which is on the inward side. So son number one didn't work. Abinadab. He comes next and nope, Lord tells Samuel he's not the one. Shema is the next one that comes, and the Lord says, nope, he's not the one either. And seven sons are there. And finally, they get to the last one. Well, I'm not so sure it was anything particular here other than God's thinking, you know, 2,000 years later, these guys got to pronounce this king, and I don't want a name like Eliab or Abinadab or Shema. David. There we go. David. Joel can even say David if he ever has to preach on this. And I'm sure that's part of the reason he said David comes. He was the youngest. He wasn't even present. You know what he was doing? He was watching the sheep. David was a shepherd. And they brought David forth and God said, He's the one. This is the one that is going to be your king. God tells Samuel to rise and anoint him, for this is the one. At that point, David was to be king. He was a shepherd. Curious. Later in life, much later in life, David would pen, "The Lord is my shepherd." He gets sheep. He gets flock stuff. He gets all of that that takes place in being a good shepherd. David was also a musician. He played the lyre for Saul. He was a musician. He understood music. He understood poetry and prose, and he wrote so much of Psalms for us because he had that background. What about Goliath? There's another background for David as well. Remember, Israel's up against the Philistines, and they figure they're gonna solve this battle like they used to do. You send us your best, and we'll send our best, and whoever wins that battle wins. The war is over. It's like WWF. They probably made a big cage thing, and they're going to put him in there, and they're going to broadcast this, and the winner of this is going to take place. The Bible tells us that the Philistines brought out this dude whose name was Goliath, who was 9 feet tall. And Israel had to send somebody forth, and they're thinking, who's going to fight that guy? That'd be like the Rock times two, big guy. Who's going to fight him? David says this. He comes up and says, "I'll do it." How are you going to do it? How are you going to beat this, big of a man? He says, "I used to keep sheep for my father," in reference to his working with sheep again. He said, "This is what happened. Whenever a lion or bear came, I took a lamb from the flock. I went after it, struck it down, rescuing the lamb from its mouth. And if it turned against me, I would catch it by the jaw, strike it down, and kill it. Your servant has killed both lions and bears, and this uncircumcised Philistine shall be like one of them, since he has defiled the armies of the living God." Man, I'd like to see that take place. All these guys are lined up, and they see Goliath's in the cage, and they're looking for somebody to come forth. And here comes this little shepherd boy. He's got a sling, and he's got rocks, and he starts telling the story about, when I was a shepherd, I killed lions, and I killed bears. That boy ain't going to be nothing. You could just almost see the rest of Israel say, "Have at her," "Have at her," and the rest of the story. So he's a shepherd, and he's brave. He kills lions, and he kills bears. He also turns into a mighty warrior. He leads his army against all those invaders of the land of Israel to victory. And when he'd come back to town and triumphantly enter into where the rest of the people were there, the women would sing, "Saul," who's still the king at the time, "Saul has slain thousands and David his tens of thousands." Well, right there started a big problem between Saul and David, because the women are singing more about David than they are me. They only said, "I killed thousands and David killed tens of thousands." And this works into a conflict between Saul and David that lasts for years until Saul is finally dethroned. And David then becomes king, and he's a victorious king. All his battles he tends to win, and he gains so much pillage from these nations and acquires all this wealth from all the people that they have controlled. And as a result, the Jewish church develops this large, vast amount of money that they can begin to do things with. But David's got some control issues as well. Not unlike me. Not unlike you as well. There's a story in the Bible where he's walking around his palace and he looks lustfully at a woman who is bathing. And he sends for her and he has her. And as a result, he ends up getting in trouble with her, and he doesn't know what he's going to do. And again, long story short, he ends up murdering this woman's husband to cover up what he had done with her. He's got control issues as well. He's taken life and under control. Rather than waiting on the Lord and waiting on direction from him, he takes life in control for himself, and he pays dearly for it because he is a murderer. He also has a control problem as he establishes all this wealth and he builds for himself this palace, mighty beautiful palace. He says, "I live in this luxury, and there the God lives in a tent. Because remember, at that time, they worshiped God in the tabernacle, and they had their Ark of the Covenant. They put it in there, and they did all that churchy stuff, but it was done in a tent. I live in this palace, and the rest of God's over there in that rickety old tent that's hundreds of years old. I'm going to build him a great house. And God tells him, don't do it. I don't want a house. I don't want you to do that. But David, control problem again, decides to do it. And as a result, the temple of in Israel is built. God comes back later on and tells him this. David, you know what? You want to build me a house, but here's what you need to know from 2 Samuel 7. When your days are fulfilled and you lie down with your ancestors, I'm going to raise up your offspring after you. You shall come forth from your body. Who shall come forth from your body? And I will establish his kingdom. He shall build a house for my name, and I will establish the throne of his kingdom forever. There God is telling David, yeah, you want to build this house for me. Let me tell you really what it's going to do. I'm going to build this house. Your son Solomon's actually going to be the architect over this. But this kingdom is going to be one that you can't even imagine what it's going to be. It's going to be a kingdom that never ends. God is prophesying to you and I and to David as well that kingdom is eventually going to bring us Christ, whose kingdom never ends, that comes through this people, that comes through a group of people who no doubt have got some control issues. So it is amazing to me as this non-historian kind of walks us through this rich history of Israel and especially David and his background. It's just amazing to me. If I think about where David would have been late in life as he would have penned Psalm 23 that you and I just read together. He was wealthy. He was at the top status of his community. All people would have bowed to him because he was king. They would have submitted to him. They would have all been inferior to him because him being king and them being his servants. And he killed bears. I can't get over that one. And lions. Grabbed them by the jaw and killed them. He was a successful warrior. Championed so many battles. He did tremendous building projects that in the time would have just been amazing. He would have done all of those things. And he writes those words, "The Lord is my shepherd." To me, if there was anyone in the world at the time that couldn't have written those words, it would have been him. Who would admit to them that I am inferior to someone else, the man at the top of the world? What an awesome, humbling statement he says right there. "The Lord is my shepherd. I shall not want." That picture that we have here is David would be really looking forward into the future when he thinks he doesn't know Jesus yet. Jesus hasn't come for another 1,000 years. But he would be sort of prophesying to us when he says that about this good shepherd that you and I know. Jesus says this about himself 1,000 years later. "Yeah, I'm the good shepherd, but I'm also the gatekeeper. And the sheep hear his voice." They hear the gatekeeper's voice. "He calls his own sheep by name and he leads them out. When he has brought out all of his own, he goes ahead of them and the sheep follow him because they know his voice." Do you know him like that? Do you know Jesus' voice? Do you know him as your shepherd? That he is the one that leads. And are you a sheep to him? Are you like that? Maybe you have people in your past like David did that have such a colored past that you think in some way keeps you from being the sheep you need to be. "I couldn't possibly do that if you just knew my dad, my mom, or my grandparents." Look at the history. Look at how God used people who had big-time control issues, who made big-time life choices that had negative effects, and God still used them in his plan to restore all of mankind to him. Maybe you have things in your life right now that are control problems for you, things where you are assuming too much control, things that are all about your own will as opposed to the will of God. David had them as well. David had control problems. He had history problems. But yet he found a place where he could give them over and assume the position of being that sheep, where he could call the Lord God his shepherd. He relinquished his own control to be a sheep. And one thing about sheep is that they're so dependent upon the shepherd. And that's what you and I need to be. How dependent are we on him? Or are we dependent on what we can control? Let's pray.